Welcome to the Growth Elevated Leadership Podcast with Julian Castelli. Each week, we talk with senior tech leaders to explore stories and insights about the challenges involved with growing technology companies. We hope that these stories can help you become a better leader and help you navigate your own growth journey.
Hi, this is Julian Castelli. I'm the host of the Growth Elevated Leadership Podcast, where each week I talk with inspirational entrepreneurs and leaders in the tech industry. Past guests have included CEOs and CXOs of great companies like Workfront, CHG Healthcare, Retica Systems, InMoment, RetailMeNot, the San Francisco 49ers, and many more. This episode is brought to you by Growth Elevated. We're a community of tech founders, CEOs, and CXOs who are committed to working together to share best practices and learnings in an effort to help all of us become better leaders. We do this through educational programs like this podcast, as well as our blog and, of course, our annual Tech Summit, which just so happens to be at the base of beautiful mountains in Utah. We've been at Park City and Alta. And so if you'd like to learn more about either the event or Growth Elevated, please check us out at growthelevated.com. And please subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Today, I am super excited about welcoming Kathy Sawinski to the podcast. Kathy's a turnaround CEO known for transforming distressed software companies into high-performing enterprises. As CEO of Jigsaw at Trilogy Software, she specializes in revitalizing companies through strategic AI implementation, process refinement, and she has an ability to consistently achieve 70% net profit margins within a year of taking over a distressed company. Kathy's track record includes successfully turning around three companies in 2024, implementing AI-first initiatives that achieve an 80% adoption rates. Her expertise spans both process and product management, go-to-market, creating scalable, profitable business models. Boards and CEOs seek out Kathy for a straightforward approach to company transformations and her ability to deliver measurable results. Let's welcome Kathy to our program, our podcast. Hey, Kathy.
Thanks for the intro, Julian. Good to see you again.
Yeah, it's great to see you as well. Tell us a little bit about you. You've been an entrepreneur at a tech company several times, and then you went over to Trilogy. Trilogy is a different type of company. So tell us a little bit about your journey from being at a tech company and then what you're doing at Trilogy and how the first maybe both influenced your interest and prepared you for the second.
Yeah, definitely. So I've done a lot of growth stage companies in my past in terms of running product management, typically product management and engineering or product management and go to market. And probably about 10 years ago, I ended up at Trilogy. I was moving overseas and wanted a role that was 100% remote. I got recruited in by a friend and totally fell in love with it. The most intense place you could work in terms of there's always something new happening. You're sometimes acquiring two, three, four companies in a single year. Expertise in various domains grows quite rapidly. So I loved it. The thing that I didn't love was I was living in Australia and the time zones were a murder to try to cross over with the US. So I left the company with a plan to come back. And then a couple of years ago, I was working for a startup that was actually distressed, running out of capital. We were trying to sell it. And we were selling it to a company in Austin, Texas. And Trilogy's actually based in Austin. I scheduled a lunch with the woman who is my boss now, DR, and said, listen, I really want to come back. I know you've got a CEO, portfolio CEO role open. You know, spent about 2 hours over a lunch. And by the time I walked away, she was like, what day can you start?
Wow.
Well, depends on the acquisition, but came back and just love it. After I actually left the first time, I found myself bored at every other company. And I know that sounds a little facetious to say, but when you get used to that much intensity and change. When you're at a single company doing one thing, you fix a bunch of things and then you sort of sit there and you're like, now what do I do? So I constantly found myself going to the CEO and saying, can you like give me another department or can you give me a special project to work on? So even after my Trilogy years, you can see in my LinkedIn profile, for instance, I always have like two or three or four departments at companies instead of just one thing, just because I love that that intensity. And things connect across areas, right? Like product and support are so highly connected. So there was a company I ran both in, came to another company as a GM and then ended up running sales, marketing, and product management, because again, they're all highly coordinated between each other. And I just found like running it all helps you remove the barriers.
Sure. So you're talking about the intensity of Trilogy, but most people don't know what kind of company that is. So walk us through.
Yeah, for sure.
Is Trilogy and how it's different than an ordinary company and how it gave you those skill sets.
Yeah, I'll give you the Cliff Notes edition. Trilogy started 35 years ago. It was bootstrapped by a gentleman named Joe Lamont. He built software from scratch, sold a pricing configuration quote tool into large companies like Ford, IBM. And somewhere around the dot-com boom, he's like, man, there's a lot of good companies out there, but they're running out of cash. They're making revenue and we're really good at operations. Why don't we start buying these companies? So let's call it 2010s, early 2010s. They started buying companies. Here we are 25 or 15 years later, 2025, and we've bought about 150 companies where we've, and they're always distressed pretty much, buy them for cash, take them over day one, and basically work on improving their operational side of their business to get them profitable. And our play is we try to keep them as long as possible. We don't typically sell the companies once in a blue moon. There's someone comes and gives us an offer we can't refuse. But typically, these are long-term holds. We use the cash.
And you're creating in cash flow with these companies, and they're probably not cash flow generating when you get them, right? So you're kind of creating alchemy, helping them turn into a cash flow stream. I've always been interested in this and can't wait to learn more about your business and Trilogy, because that's frankly why SaaS companies get premium multiples, because of the recurring revenue and theoretical high margins. There's always the theory that, hey, this business, should we hit the top of the market or things slow down, we should be able to have a recurring cash flow stream. But a lot of the companies in the early stages never get there, right? Because they're at the formation and growth stages. And you are actually taking those same companies, but getting them to that cash flow level, which is kind of alchemy. And I can't wait to hear how you do that.
Yeah. Our companies tend to be a little bit longer in the tooth in terms of like been around for a while. Like let's say average is 17 years in terms of operating, but they just get to plateaus where they can't grow anymore. They're trying as hard as they can, and then they're burning their cash too fast. So wait for them.
And this is a trend, right? There's a number of companies that are doing this now. Who are some of the other, who are some of your peers in the tech space that
probably the
this best, heard about?
Yeah, the best well known company out there is Constellation. They're a Canadian company. They do pretty much
Constellation. Yeah,
the same thing we do. There's lots of other smaller boutique ones, but a lot of times we find ourselves up against them in the bid process.
Got it. And you're on the operations side. Is there another group that's out there looking at companies and kind of constantly bringing them in?
And yes.
Do they have different, are you organized by sector or, how, you know, so if the acquisition group is bringing a company in, do they have multiple places to send it or what's your structure?
Great questions. We do have a dedicated A group led by Niraj Gupta, but if you got something for sale, reach out to me and I'll connect you with Niraj. He's got a small team. Then within Trilogy Software, we have four CEOs, and depending on what type of software it is and basically our capacity is where we decide which CEO gets acquisition. So we have a CEO that is dedicated to telco only.
Okay.
On a rampage buying tens of companies in the telco space. We have two CEOs in the enterprise space, and now we have a CEO that we've hired in the services space, specifically
around
AI services is our goal here. And he's building new products as well as acquiring.
And what's Jigsaw's focus? That's your group?
Enterprise software. I do have a couple SMB products. We are 100% B2B, and the bulk of my portfolio is enterprise.
And I read it right. You transformed three companies last year?
Yes.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, thanks. It was a busy year, to say the least. We did $35 million worth of revenue purchased through acquisitions. So three small companies, and all of them were negative margins. I think the worst case scenario one was about negative 40% margin. And I've turned all of those around. They're all trending towards a 70% or already at 70% margin. Within four quarters
is that
it's a net EBITDA margin.
Yeah. And what's their growth profile before and after?
They were not growing. They're flat.
Okay.
So a lot of times these companies that we buy are somewhere in that, like, let's call it 10-year mark of being operating, and they've gone through a growth cycle, they've gotten funding, and then they've hit the accelerator with the funding, but hit it way too hard and can't find that next ICP to grow into, or don't have the right, you know, product features to get to that ICP. So they're trying to build while growing and just tend to burn through their cash way too fast. And often we find they've made like a decision and sort of don't pivot quick enough before it's too late, and or don't make the hard decisions to, you know, revert back to what they're doing or pivot a different direction or let go of people or slow things down till they find the right next ICP to sell into.
They're burning too much cash looking for growth. And when they get to you then, so you're, you know, you guys are okay with the growth rate, but you're primarily focused on operations, and you're going to create the alchemy by improving cash flow. So what's your general playbook? Do you have a playbook when a new company comes in? Is there a set of standard things you look for to get your biggest impact and bang for the buck?
Yeah. Even before with a playbook, as part of the acquisition playbook, we want companies that have great retention rates, but we don't care if their growth is totally stalled. As long as we know we can retain the existing customer base, we're willing to invest in the company. Post-acquisition, we do the hard things that typically the CEOs don't want to do, which is shed the people. It's almost always our day one thing. We call it the Dr. Spock and Mother Teresa approach. When you get acquired, everyone is more or less stressed out, freaking out a little bit. They want to know where their future lies, right? And we try to be very transparent and say, like, the only way to get these companies back to profitability is to cut the costs, right? So there's usually two main cost centers. One is people, and the second is things like offices, right? Like assets you don't need. So those are pretty quick to cut. But we're very transparent with people. Day one, we do an all hands. We, you know, tell them, we already formulate how much we have to cut to get to a number that's reasonable to get into profitability space again. We let people know. We create a plan. And I'll give you an example. If we have to cut a third on day one, we let them know. And we let them know that day one, that's who's getting cut. And if we know we're cutting another third maybe after 6 months, we let them know on day one they're getting cut. We actually call it pay to quit. Like, we say, hey, if you're not ready for this, you don't want to stick around, this isn't for you, we will actually pay you to quit. But either way, you know, you have 6 months to go find another job. And we are totally fine looking for another role as long as you help us with the transition into our playbook, into our central functions, into our model. But we try to be super transparent with people because it's probably the worst thing to get acquired and just like not know what's going to happen. Like, are you going to have a job in 3 months or not? Well, you'll know.
There's stress already. A lot of times it's stress because you're concerned about this. And then I think if you do some research, you're going to find out how tight your company operates. So of course that's going to be stressful. So I'm glad to hear you guys are very forthcoming and open with your employees. But let me ask a question. So there are some companies and management teams that never get their foot off the gas because they want to grow. Maybe they misjudge the market, but there are plenty that try to cut and find it difficult because they're small companies and they need people. Do you have any special capabilities that allow you to cut faster and deeper than the companies on a standalone basis?
Yeah, two things. One is we have central functions. Again, we've been around for 35 years.
Give me an example of a central function, how that works.
Support, right? So we support 100 products with one support team, and everyone gets certified on the products. We also use a ton of AI in support. Right now we call it deflection rates. I think we're at like 76% deflection rate on our customer support tickets. So that means 76% of our tickets that come in, AI can answer in real time.
They're solved without a human.
Right. We used to have a 200 person support team. We're down to 30 people because of the AI that we've put in. So that's even saved us ton of money, which
supports one of the best use cases for AI, right?
Definitely. So central functions, support, finance, even engineering. Like, we have a central support function for our engineering side of the house where they manage all the maintenance and the bug fix, right? We order humans to manage it. And now it's becoming more and more AI, quite honestly.
Right.
And
narrow your acquisition funnel though, right? You have to have products that are built in a certain way that your centralized R&D team can manage. Does that, that seems like the other ones make total sense. Support, finance, HR. I can understand if you have scale capabilities there, but see, I would think that engineering is where people would have the most surprise from the outside in, because it seems like everyone's built their own ball of yarn and their own stack. And are you able to really scale when you have different tech stacks? And
as part of the acquisition process, we do a lot of documentation and knowledge transfer, and we try to get everything written down, how it works, videos of how it all works. So we don't ever lose that knowledge, and that stays in a knowledge bank. The coolest thing with AI now too is we can put it into something called the RAG. So you can query the RAG questions about how things are built. But the answer is no. We have everything from old school on-premise software, right? Built 30 years ago in our portfolio that we still do releases on, and we have to keep it up to date because we have hundreds of customers on it, right up to modern AI platforms written in Python. So we've got the gamut of things. There are specialists, people that really get to know the software well within the company. We're 1,000 people deep. So it's, we're okay to have a few people that really know a couple of the platforms well.
Sure.
But we don't find too many problems with different types of platforms because of the knowledge transfer process we do. And then in general, the skill set of folks we hire, we try to. One of the other big things we do is we hire globally all over the world.
And okay. So you've got a deep team and an efficient team.
Very efficient. But we don't play the game of like we're hiring globally because we want a cheap resource. We take the approach of if it's a K engineering role, we will find the best human in the world for that 200K versus constraining ourselves to one geography. And I think that helps as well in terms of just finding the best talent in the world. And people love working for us and stay with us for years. We've got people in the company they've been around for 10, 15, 20 years, which is sort of unheard of in technology.
That's amazing, especially when, the complexity of what you guys are doing. So tell me, what are the big, your top three, if this was a Wheel of Fortune or something, we're saying, hey, your top three efficiency drivers that you consistently see over and over again, or Family Feud. What are the top three boxes?
Top three is clean up the roadmap. Try not to do everything for everyone. Figure out what the core use cases are for the customers who are paying you right now because you want to retain them and work on that. So, you and I were talking about it before the call. You join these companies sometimes, or you buy these companies sometimes, and you see these roadmaps where they're 6 months, 12 months, 18 months of tech debt. And I'm like, who are you tech debting for? Is the platform falling apart? Is it fall over every day? If that's not happening, then I don't like.
What's an example of tech that you need to do and tech that you can just postpone or not even ever do? Because I think that as a non-technical founder, I used to get paralyzed with the anxiety of like, hey, the machine's going to break if we don't fix XYZ. And then it's just like you described, you'll end up 6 months, 9 months of at least commercial inactivity while you're building infrastructure, what it feels like. So when is it to do that safely and when is it not?
I would say the things that I would cut is let's modernize the language that we're using. Let's use the latest, hottest version of whatever, if it was written in, Java, and now they want to move to Python or something.
Right.
Don't do that. We can
support in Java. We can get the job.
Or we often buy companies are older languages like .NET, right? Most .NET developers are north of 50 at this stage.
Hard to find these days, right?
Hard to find, but the amount of money you'll spend rebuilding from .NET to Python, for instance, you'll never recoup in revenue or cost savings later on. Yeah, it's harder to find people, but with AI now, AI can help.
That's right.
Your non-.NET developers learn to use .NET a lot faster. So that's one that I think is a huge throwaway of money. The other ones that I see is they built two products and they want to merge them because,
consolidate the platform. The new, the, no. the, I bet you the new platform that's going to do everything in a better, more efficient way. If I had a dollar for every time I heard that.
Right. And not only consolidate the platform, but like throw a new UX UI on. Again, 6 months to 12 months, plus then the users get all cranky because they're like, can't find the thing that I used all the time because the workflows change. So to me, those always end up in the tech debt. I mean, UX isn't so much tech debt, but they end up in those like sunken costs that you'll never see again. Places you're going to want to spend money on is like security, vulnerabilities, right? Certifications, like if you're using some flavor of Java behind the scenes, making sure you don't have to be at the latest version, right? Just figure out like the version that's not going to be deprecated for 4 or 5 more years, and you got some room to go. But you get people that are insistent, like, got to be on the newest version of this, otherwise bad things will happen. And it's like, what bad thing will happen? Sure. So those are probably the ones I make sure get done.
When you go in there and you find, you're effectively reprioritizing or narrowing the product roadmap, what scale of reduction are you typically able to make in the R&D cash flow department?
North of 50%, maybe even.
So you're able to cut 50% costs by just going through with this disciplined approach of let's not replatform, let's not language. Let's just make sure the product keeps working, and you have the expertise to make sure that it's going to keep working and it's going to have appropriate security. Like you said, 50% cut there,
right?
That's a big deal. Yeah. And what percentage of the expense base of companies coming in is typically R&D?
Depending on the company, on the low end, probably 30, on the high end, 50, depending on the company. Yes.
There's 15 to 25% cash flow improvement right there.
Easily, very easily.
Okay, so what are other categories? What are your other big categories?
Yeah, another area, quite honestly, is the optimization of their cloud infrastructure. Often teams don't have people, like DevOps people, that really understand how to optimize and get the most out of.
Right.
We're an AWS shop, and we often see just crazy things like 3 data center redundancies. And I'm like, have you even ever had to fail over to one other data center? Why are we paying for multiple redundancies? That's one area. Oversizing the servers that they need and just not.
When with AWS, you can have a variable capacity, right?
Right. And running them at maybe 50, 60% capacity versus really working on that. And a lot of times, like, engineers don't have a background in infrastructure. That's a very different skill set. So not having people in-house that really understand infrastructure is a big factor. We're right now, the company that we most recently purchased, we will reduce our AWS bill by 50% by the end of this quarter. We only bought the company in end of August, I believe. So it goes to show, right? Like, again, they have multiple data centers. And even when you're doing the optimization of the infrastructure, sometimes you just find things that like haven't been updated. So this company, again, they send a ton of emails, and they were only able to do like 250,000 a day. And we were able to now get them up to 1 million emails a day, which means the end users can use the product more, right? We offer unlimited emailing now as part of the services. So they're getting more value out of the product, and we're actually reducing the cost because we moved to a different mailing provider, basically within AWS. So it's just like going
fantastic
chunk by chunk through the infrastructure stack and understanding like what can be optimized. Even just, we don't do anything crazy like I call it heart surgery when you like replace a database, but optimizing SQL queries, right? Like having someone that understands database tuning. A lot of times that's just not there in engineering shops. And it's amazing how much money is just spent on cloud infrastructure and is wasted.
Okay. So I've got, you know, it sounds like customer support, number one, R&D, number two. What's your third on the big board where you find the best efficiency gains?
A super easy one. It's not probably the best, but it's like the easiest one is offices. Real estate.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, no one really wants to come into the office. I mean, I do miss it. I actually have a workspace now, same place you're at.
Yeah.
But it's just to be around humans once in a while. But
right.
At the end of the day, when you're short on cash and you've got a fancy office at a expensive expensive address, do you really need it, right? I mean, how many people are coming in? It's an easy expense to drop.
What percentage of your companies are you able to cab off big recurring expenses through real estate reductions?
100% of our companies go remote after we buy them.
How you know, that sometimes, you know, real estate leases are long term. So are you able to kind of sublease typically, or sometimes you have to wait 18 months till the next term renewal? What, any tricks there?
We either try to sublease, or sometimes it's just worth paying the penalty to
break it, break the lease. Yeah.
But huge cost savings. I mean, that sometimes is somewhere between 5 and 15% of cost for a company, and just easy money to get back to.
Do you typically replace it with some shared space? Do you, or does everyone just go home?
Everyone goes home.
So you don't, if they want to have a company meeting, what do they do?
Great question. We do a ton of offsites, honestly. Okay. I'm hosting an offsite here in Utah next week for my leadership team. I just had my whole sales team in Montenegro because they're globally based, and it was the easiest place for everyone to get to with direct, like some semblance of a direct flight. There's another one coming up, I think, in late March in Chicago. So we just do offsites, but the cost of an offsite is pennies on the dollar compared to keeping real estate that no one goes to.
And I bet you it's really special when you do get your people together. So there's a little bit more excitement and positivity there. What about sales and marketing? That's what we haven't talked. And I think you mentioned earlier, that's the one group that you kind of continue to want to have longevity in, right? That it's a little different than maybe some of the other categories. How do you treat sales and marketing and go to market?
Yeah, that's a place that we're starting to really delve more into AI. So we've now built AI agents that schedule all of our meetings for us with incoming leads. We are doing a lot more of our content generation using AI, our SEO optimization using AI. I know everyone says like AI can't do it, and I totally disagree. You just have to spend, it's not like a go write one prompt and you've already solved the problem. You've got to get very sophisticated with the way you're using your AI tools. And we have something called brain lifts, where we write these like guides so that AI stays within boundaries of what we want it to do.
Right.
Doesn't just pull like general information.
It's a teenager with hallucinations. You have to give it guidelines.
Exactly. So really getting sophisticated with that, optimizing the crap out of our funnels is, we run an experiment every single week and everything is measured. Like if you can't measure it, you can't make it better.
Is go-to-market now centralized, or is it still maybe a hybrid between specialized per company and your central team that has some expertise? What's the structure of go-to-market at a newly acquired company?
We keep it in the business unit. So it is.
So that stays in the business.
Specialized. Yes. But you
have all these experiential AI improvements at the mothership that you can implement and coach and help with. Is that how it works?
Definitely. So it comes into the commercial side. So into the business unit that I run, which is focused on the products within my portfolio. They do span across multiple products, but it's a lot of rinse repeat. Like what we're going to do for one product, you can do for another product.
Right. So you specialize a new technique one place, you can apply it elsewhere because you have this.
The other big thing we do is like we'll share our learnings with the other three business units, mm-hmm. right? So we do like collaborate across each other's, but GTM just isn't centralized at this stage. I think it's too hard because of the specialization within at the product level.
Yeah.
You really have to have some domain expertise at the level.
Got it. How about the management level? If you're part of the management team of an acquired company, what part of that group do you keep intact? And what are the key elements of people that you transition to the other things?
Depends on the acquisition, but quite honestly, because we do 100% cash acquisitions day one, the management team is released quite quickly. Sometimes we keep a few people around for transition purposes, but it's rare that management sticks around because we have our own centralized function.
Yeah, they plug into your structured matrix management. Okay, that makes sense. And so it sounds like AI, I mean, this business has been around for a long time. So this is not an AI-driven business historically. It's an efficiency and operational expertise, value creation hypothesis. But now so many of these areas. Not only do you have centralized expertise and operational expertise, but now you got AI as this additional benefit. How long has that been going on, and what's this AI curve been looking like for you guys?
2 years, probably, it's been going on. Back half of 2023, I really started to push it, so 18 months ago. And we probably 2 years ago, we were at like zero or single digit AI use. People were, you know, ChatGPT had just come out. We were dabbling with it. And now it's to a point where we're now measuring AI use per week. We have ways to like monitor what apps you're using on your computer. And we're averaging in my functional area, like 60% every single week of 60% of our time working on our computers, we're using some sort of AI tool to help us.
I saw you had a measurement of AI utilization. I didn't know what that meant. So break that down. What does that mean? How are you measuring and who are you measuring and what are they doing with AI? As an example,
I'll use myself as an example. The tool we use basically grabs sort of screenshots of what you're doing throughout the day, and it coaches you. The coach is kind of new, but it tells you, hey, like, your task switching too much. You should like bundle your time, or you're doing this thing. Did you think about you're writing this newsletter? Did you think about how AI can help you write this newsletter? So, for instance, I launched a newsletter, I think at the end of last year, to help other leaders with their companies becoming more AI forward. And I in the beginning, I was writing it by hand, but I'm like, man, this is so time consuming and I can't come up with stuff. Now I use various AI tools. So I use something called Super Whisper to dictate a lot of what I used to type. And God knows we all type so much every day. So I can probably get what's in my brain out into a prompt in 2 minutes versus typing for 10, 15 minutes to write. Like
now you've mastered that. Was it hard at first to shift from typing to talking? Did it take some practice?
Yes. In terms of remembering that I have the feature, like I'll just start typing and I'm like, what am I doing? This is so slow. But it's something I've always said, like once this becomes mainstream and it's very accurate, I'll be using it all the time. And my team jokingly says I get a commission for Super Whisper because I tell everyone to use it. I don't. I think it's $250 lifetime. And I'm like, I make that up every hour that I use it.
Sure.
Right. In terms of efficiency and productivity. But I dictate. We have a tool that we've built in-house called Effort. We're actually launching it.
Does it automatically, logically organize your sentences, right? Because as I speak, sometimes my stream of consciousness is not the most organized or structured. And whereas when I write, I can kind of see it and then restructure it. Does your tool give you the chance to, you just shared five sentences, but you want to rework them or you said something twice?
No.
Does it give you that kind of capability?
It doesn't, but it's easy to just kind of copy, paste, or edit, you know, if you want to throw.
So it gets the words on the page, but you're still going to do a little polishing yourself. Is that correct?
Yeah, but quite honestly, often I just use AI to polish it. I don't.
Sure. Okay, so AI can polish it as well.
Absolutely. So
the first is dictation to get it on the page, and then you can refine using your own brain and AI. Okay.
Yeah. So we built a tool called Effort. It's only internal use right now. The whole company's been using it for the last few months. It'll be external soon, but it has access to every single LLM that's out there. So everything from ChatGPT, Claude, Grok, Gemini, Llama, you name it. We have 20 LLMs in it. And now we've added the reasoning models in the last month or so as well. So I just go to Effort, sort of talk what my thoughts are. And I ask Effort, I'm like, can you make this have some semblance of organization? And it'll take
clean it up.
Clean it up. I built a style guide to how I want to write, for instance. So like the other night, my head of marketing pinged me and was like, I need another round of AI boss. And I was like, oh man, I'm tired. It's 10 o'clock. I want to go to bed, but I got to get this done. Let's see if I can do it in 10 minutes. And between a stream of conscious of talking into Effort, and I've already got it. I've got a project set up where it just writes my newsletters based on my format that I spent a couple hours building the format out. But now it just sort of puts it into that format. I basically talk. I hit go on Effort. It takes a minute for it to like spit it out, maybe even less. And then I just move it to Grammarly, do some slight adjustments in less than 10 minutes. I've got a full like newsletter.
It's fantastic.
In meantime, this is all like, even as CEO, I monitor my time because I think it's like, I want to see how much AI usage I'm getting. So this is all getting sort of monitored and it gets picked up. And I can check every day, like what my percentage of time using AI for the week is. So like this week, I'm averaging 25% for the week, right? But, you know, it's hilarious. It's 7 p.m. on Sunday when the reports come out and my whole team is like bragging with each other in one of the chat groups, like, what'd you get? And
that's great.
It's a competition every week to see who's got the highest score. But we've got people, our engineers are hitting 90% AI use because they're using tools to help them code now.
And I love the fact that you can actually measure the AI usage. And I'm sure you're seeing it trickle into other your traditional metrics, but that's the first time I've heard actually the measurement of the actual utilization of the tools, which is great.
It's not only measuring it there, we're seeing it with the results, right? We're getting releases out the door to our customers. We're solving bugs and problems so much faster. We're seeing it sort of everywhere. It's not just, you know, hey, you're using it 90% of your time. Like there's so much, we're probably pumping out 4 to 5 times more content from like marketing and sales and engineering and product in terms of like deliverables and releases than we did a year ago, maybe even less.
It's amazing. So Kathy, you're a couple of years in now, removed from a single startup to, I'm gonna just summarize what you've told me as being in the efficiency factory. What do you know now that you wish you knew back when you were in the chair helping to guide a startup? And what were some of the biggest lessons you could share with our listeners?
Don't be afraid to say out loud that you've done the wrong thing and you need to change the decision you made, right? Like we all make mistakes, but sometimes people go down with the ship with their mistakes. I see it all the time with the companies we acquire. So don't be afraid to change, but lead the change management as well. Don't be the CEO that just sits in the office and like doesn't come out and talk to the people and doesn't know what's going on and doesn't talk to customers. That's a big thing. Like one or two conversations with customers will really help you understand the health of your product and your business than looking at a spreadsheet. Right. So get out there and
talk. Get up.
And you know, sometimes you're going to have uncomfortable conversations. People will tell you your baby is ugly and you have to be okay with that. So that's probably some of the things. The other thing is make the hard decisions sooner than later. Like letting go of people is hard because you've built relationships with them. You know that they've, you know, got bills to pay, but sometimes people just hold on too long and then, you know, realize they're really in a tight spot financially because they thought they could make it up with sales, right? And just doesn't happen. So let go, like make your decisions ahead of the curve, way ahead of when you're going to need the money. Don't wait till you need the money to let go of people. Like you're too late then.
Yeah,
that's the
exactly right.
So key effect, you know, make your hard decisions ahead of the curve of where you're going to be in the sticky spot. And that's hard to do, right? Because
yes,
like,
sure
you're an optimist and you're like, we're going to pull through. Everything's going to be fantastic.
That's right.
The reality is, you know, you might have, if you have best and worst case scenario, you'll end up somewhere in between, hopefully, but even that won't get you through. So make those decisions sooner than later, the hard ones.
So you have some optionality. That makes a lot of sense. Well, Kathy, this is great. I can't wait to continue our conversation because I want to continue to learn from you. You've learned so much. Where can I find your AI newsletter? What's it called? Where can I find it?
It's literally theaiboss.ai. You go to the site, you should be able to sign up. Also, if you find me on LinkedIn, there's a newsletter sign up. Also on Twitter at Case Lewinsky. I'm spending a ton of time on Twitter these days. I was a little anti it for a long time. I was like, it's too much information, but it's another one of those things. If you spend the time and you curate what you're being exposed to, you can learn a ton of stuff. Constantly out there just learning more about AI and what's going on and trying to stay on top of hundreds of developments that are happening monthly.
Absolutely. That's great advice. Well, Kathy, I enjoyed talking with you this morning and I'm super excited about what you've shared with the audience. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Julian. See you soon.
All right. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Growth Elevated Leadership Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, would you please follow us and subscribe on your favorite podcast player? And we'd be grateful if you recommend it to a friend. If you'd like more resources on how to become a better leader in business, we invite you to visit us at growthelevated.com. We'll be back next week with more insight from another great tech leader. Thank you.